Tonight's Clear Spot is the final programme of interviews recorded by me, Mags Hall, at this year's School of Sound, a unique international symposium exploring sound design in film and radio. Tonight's programme features interviews with Chris Petit, director of the cult film Radio On, Oscar-nominated Ren Kleiss, sound designer on David Fincher's Fight Club, Seven and Being John Malkovich, Academy Award-nominated sound designer Tom Fleischman, who's worked with Martin Scorsese, Jonathan Demme and Spike Lee, and composer Gabriel Yared, who's known for his collaborations with Anthony Minghella, as well as writing the score of Betty Blue and The Talented Mr. Ripley. Chris Petit is the quintessential cult British director, having placed Kraftwerk firmly on the soundtrack of his film Radio On, and collaborated with the musician Bruce Gilbert on his later films. I spoke to him at this year's School of Sound.
My name is Chris Petit. I'm an occasional filmmaker, an occasional writer, an occasional novelist, and one day I will decide what it is I should be doing.
Film obviously seems to be quite a big passion in your life, but perhaps music is a bigger passion.
Yeah, I think when I started, because I had never made a film in 1979, and I got the chance to make Radio On, and because I didn't really know how to direct, I kind of used the music as in a way the lifeline in the film, and in a way the soundtrack always came first, and for pretty obvious reasons, really. The radio cassette was a relatively recent invention in terms of being able to program music in a car. And for me, there was a fantastic sense of kind of liberation of being able to kind of drive and listen to music at the same time. And the thing that struck me about television and English cinema was that this kind of music that you grew up with listening to on the radio, you never heard in English movies, that if you wanted to hear the Kinks in a film, you had to go to Wim Wenders and German cinema. If you wanted to hear the Walker Brothers in a film, you had to go to German cinema and Rainer Werner Fassbinder. And even if you wanted to hear Cream in a film, you had to go to, or Blind Faith rather, you had to go to kind of Werner Herzog and a film called Fata Morgana. And I could never really understand this. And so I thought, I mean, the only really bright idea I had about Radio On was that it should have a lot of music in it, and that the playlist went through several incarnations, and I think at one stage it was going to end with The Clash singing I'm So Bored with the USA, and I think in a previous incarnation it was going to end with The Doors singing 5 to 1. But this was sort of always provisional, and it wasn't really until I came across Kraftwerk quite late, I think it was Trans-Europe Express, that I kind of actually realised there was the music. I mean, this was absolutely perfect. Perfect kind of cinematic music, and it had that kind of same sense of epiphany that you got from driving at speed and listening to sounds.
One of the things that you mentioned today in your talk was the fact that the most expensive thing in the film was getting clearance rights to use this music, and that you had to pose as a journalist to Kraftwerk to sort of try and convince them that they should lend you some of their tracks. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, in 1978, I was film editor at Time Out, and I think that's still what's going to get stuck on my gravestone, ex Time Out film editor. But the Richard Williams, who'd been the editor at Time Out, had gone off to edit Melody Maker, and we had lunch, and by that stage, Radio On was in the planning stage, and Wim Wenders was the executive producer. And I'd worked out that I wanted Kraftwerk's music in the film. And Richard wanted somebody to go to Germany to explore the kind of German disco, the emerging German disco scene. And I said, oh, that sounds like a really nice job. And whoever does it should travel only by train, stay in station hotels and take Polaroids. And at the end of the lunch, he said, do you want the job? So I said, well, I don't know anything about music to write about it. But I thought, actually, Kraftwerk, Dusseldorf. So I managed to interview them for Melody Maker. And in those days, they were, you know, perfectly accessible. And I spent a couple of days with them, and then sort of rather sheepishly at the end of the 2 days, presented them with the folder with the script for Radio On. And they were kind of sweetness and light about it. There was no, you know, they said yes. They said you can take as much as you like. And I suppose because it had never, you know, because it happened so easily, I never actually realized at the time how difficult or how extraordinary this was. And I mean, the strange thing about them is that I haven't actually ever heard their music in any other film or scene associated with any other images. I mean, that may not be true, but Radio On is the only film I know which uses Kraftwerk.
Also, thinking about the other tunes that you'd used on the soundtrack, for instance, Lena Lovitch, which I'm a huge fan of that tune. I was very dismayed to hear that you actually didn't like it, but you'd had included it in the film. Can you tell us why?
It's just one of those. It's rather in the way that I never liked Elvis Costello. It's something to do with you know, why don't I like Elvis Costello? Why do I like Brian Ferry? Why? And it's something to do with voice. And the way these people sing into a microphone, and I kind of, I don't know, there was, in fact, I don't dislike it as much as I said I disliked it, but it's not one of those songs that stuck, that I have fond memories of, in the way that I have very fond memories of the Devo version of Satisfaction, which I think is far more interesting than the original Rolling Stones version. And we were, because we'd done a deal with Stiff Records, my real target as far as Stiff Records was concerned was the wonderful Reckless Eric. And I wanted to use a track of his called Hell Wide World, which I still think is a kind of classic sort of pop track. And we used that earlier in the film. And then we were Stiff Record was sort of very keen for us to use the Lovage, because I think it went to number one about the time that we were filming. And actually it works very well over the sequence that it's shot with, which is a kind of scene in a pool room, and the actor gets kicked off his chair, and then you have this, I think, really great sound cut to the middle of the Devo track. Maybe, which goes on. You think there's a sound fault, or the record's stuck, or you think something's gone wrong, and then you actually realise it is actually part of the song.
Reminds me of The Man That Fell to Earth slightly, this idea of the alien walking around the landscapes. But you also mentioned that there's a link to Eddie Cochran's life.
I mean, the thing is, when I started writing Radio On, I knew it involved a journey. I had to get the main character from London to Bristol. I knew I sort of had to get him off the motorway, because otherwise, there's no opportunity for incident. And I knew that, certain things had to happen. And one obvious thing was Chippenham, which was where Eddie Cochran had died, I think, in 1960. He'd been playing at the Bristol Hippodrome, and he was being driven back in a taxi which crashed into a lamppost in Chippenham, and he died as a result of his injuries. And I think in the original script, I think there was just one line where the character said something like, "Salute to Eddie Cochran," as he drove through Chippenham. And then I thought, well, to get the film up to kind of feature length, perhaps something could happen in Chippenham. So we kind of came up with this scene which involved the guy stopping off at a garage and meeting this kind of kid who was in a caravan, who was kind of sort of mildly obsessed with Cochrane. And in the end, the scene, the musician was actually played by Sting, who at the time was being pushed very hard by his agent for an acting career. And she was trying to get me to see him for the lead. And this was before Police had really broken. I think they broke pretty much the time that we were filming. And so Sting turned up for 2 days and he played Three Steps to Heaven and he did his scene and he disappeared. And then about 3 weeks later, the German sound recorders and the German cameraman were in New York doing a film and the Police were playing their queues around the block. I mean, they'd gone stratospheric in the space of about 2 weeks. I wanted to kind of put in a mention of Cochrane, and it turned out that the policeman on duty of the night of the crash was Dave D, of Dave D, Dozy, Beaky, McIntitch. He was a whatever they call him, not an apprentice policeman, but he was a policeman at the time. I'm gonna raise a fuss, I'm gonna raise a holler about a working all summer just to try to earn a dollar. Every time I call my baby, try to get a date, my boss says,
no dice, son, you gotta work late.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime blues. Son, you gotta make some money. If you wanna use a car to go a ride next Sunday. Oh well, I didn't go to work, told the boss I was sick.
Now you can't use a car cause you didn't work a lick.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime blues. Take 2 weeks, gonna have a fun vacation. I'm gonna take my problem to the United Nations. Well, I called my congressman and he said, whoa,
I'd like to help you, son, but you're too young to vote.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime blues.
You remixed this film again in 1988, which you've explained. But within that remix, when I was watching it, the parts that I saw of it today, it reminded me actually of this sort of ambient films made by Bill Drummond and Jimmy Cauty. I don't know if you're familiar with the work of the KLF. And I was thinking they must have been influenced by your film. And then, interestingly enough, in one of your latest films, The Faulkner, you actually used the KLF on the soundtrack. Was that because there was some link there?
KLF and Drummond, I think Ian Sinclair is well connected with them. And Drummond tells Sinclair that Radio On was a seminal film in that. I think that they kind of latched on to the notion of it's the quality of boredom in the film and that sense of emotional drift and a kind of absence of imposed dramatics. And yeah, so I think these things kind of sort of feed off each other in the way that kindred spirits who don't necessarily get together often do. And when Ian told me this story, it didn't surprise me that they'd sort of seen Radio On. And I think by the time it came, I think what you said earlier about The Man Who Fell to Earth is sort of true, that I approached the whole subject as a kind of science fiction. And it was a sort of degree zero film, because what I wanted to avoid was that whole kind of class structure, which was even more pronounced then than it is now. I mean, it's still pretty pronounced, but I thought, I don't want to get into kind of middle class. I just thought I want to I want to just get all that out of the way and do a film which is largely about looking and listening, which is why I kept the story really stripped down and was able to use the German element as much as possible to again distance oneself from that Englishness. And as an example of that, I watched Antonioni's film Blow Up the other day, which was shot in London in 1966, and it's got David Hemmings and Vanessa Redgrave and I think Jane Birkin in it. And it's amazing how kind of English they all sound. There's a sort of, I don't know whether it's sort of, there's kind of actor's voice and I don't know whether with age these films get sort of higher and higher, but it sounded very stagey. And I wanted to avoid that, and I think we managed to do that. It's being re-released on DVD, or it's being released on DVD, sometime this year by the British Film Institute. And I think they're going to put on Radio On, and I think they're going to put on Radio On Remix as well.
Now, two other people that you have collaborated with, obviously you've mentioned Ian Sinclair, but also, this talking of sound, as we are at the Sound Symposium, your collaborations with Bruce Gilbert, have you found that he's influenced the way you think about sound?
Bruce Gilbert first turned up through Ian again, and he was introduced to me as a man who kind of, quite mysterious, and he sat in these public spaces and sort of put together sort of eavesdrop soundtracks, and he sounded rather like the Gene Hackman character from The Conversation. And I didn't know why, except by sort of reputation. And we had him do stuff for us on The Falconer, where we wanted to kind of add a level of ambience to the film. And since then, we've regularly collaborated, always very pleasantly and very successfully, barely meeting. We had this kind of postal relationship, you know, I send him off a tape and he sends a tape back, and we bump into each other, you know, maybe once every 3 years. And it's restricted to kind of phone calls. And I don't even have to say that much to Bruce. It's like one of those collaborations where the other person, you say, well, I kind of want something like this. And then it comes back, but only better, which is, you know, I mean, it's the same collaboration that I had with Martin Schaefer, who shot Radio On, that it looked exactly as you wanted it to look, except better. And Bruce's stuff, exactly what you how you want it to sound, but it sounds better. And the stuff in Radio On Remix, which I just think is, you know, you get a shift in sound, and the way that he uses that kind of slightly electronic choral stuff, I think is fantastic. Money was always difficult, except at the beginning. I mean, the Radio On was actually very easily funded through a combination of something called the British Film Institute Production Board, which is now defunct, thanks largely to Alan Parker, I think. And secondly, through German co-production money. And the film was made very little money, with a kind of agreement with the unions that you could, you know, actually pay everyone less than the union rate. But the problem with after that, I didn't really have anywhere to go, because there's not, for somebody like me, there wasn't any obvious next port of call. And in the early 80s, television was pretty much a closed shop. The gap between, say, making a film like Radio One and the British film industry was still pretty huge. And anyway, as I kind of went on, although I did do a couple of things within the kind of context of commercial cinema, I thought, you know, I don't actually want a career in this. I don't want to, you know, make these films. So by the 1990s, I kind of changed tack and went into TV documentaries, initially fairly conventional ones, simply because, you know, you could set them up pretty fast. You didn't have to spend 2 years trying to get the money. You shot them, you edited them, you handed them over. And also with the BBC, you could actually raid their record library. So if you, in 1993, I think it was, I made a documentary which is called A History of the Air Stewardess, which I actually wanted to do. And I was thinking about, well, what music do I use? And I was actually listening to lots of stuff like Burt Camfort to try and get the kind of Muzak effect. And I was kind of making myself ill doing this. So I thought, well, actually, why don't I just slap on what I've been listening to? So I took Leonard Cohen's track, Everybody Knows, and it makes perfect sense over a shot of air stewardesses handing out drinks and food off a trolley. And I think I used Van Morrison's In the Days Before Rock and Roll. And you could do that because, you know, it was covered by the BBC license. I mean, generally, as things have gone on, it's become sort of harder to raise money, especially when you get to a kind of certain age, because the industry is and television is fairly youth obsessed. You know, you become sort of veteran at a certain point, and your kind of financial rating drops a few notches. So, the latest film, as a result, is a kind of combination of various co-productions, Finland, Germany, two sources of finance, America, Channel 4. But, you know, it takes ages to put it all together.
Well, I think it's interesting you say that you feel like you're a veteran already, having made. How many films do you think you've shot altogether now?
I made four feature films between 1979 and 1984. I then did Miss Marple, A Caribbean Mystery for the BBC. And then during the 90s, I did a load of documentaries. And I don't know how many films I've done altogether, but I suppose I've been working 25 years. And actually, you know, I mean, people of my age who had perfectly respectable careers in the BBC as documentary filmmakers, I think they're finding it harder and harder to kind of work. So you kind of always have to keep jumping ahead or working out ways of reinventing yourself, because there isn't such a thing as kind of job for life in the way that there used to be. And the other thing I think is, which is harder and harder for anyone to do, is you're not really allowed to make mistakes anymore. You know, you see it happening to young filmmakers that if the film doesn't stick, that's it. You don't get asked back. And actually, you know, making mistakes is half the fun. I mean, I think, you know, it's part of that process of learning. And that if, like me, you've been allowed to make mistakes for long enough, that the career by default becomes interesting. You know, if you mess it up often enough and you carry on doing it, there's a point where it starts to look interesting. You know, whereas 15 years ago, you'd have thought, well, not sure about where he's going. But by sheer dint of persistence, it does kind of start to add up. And so I was really quite surprised when Radio On resurfaced last year and was re-released. And I kind of, I looked at it and I thought, well, what was all the fuss about at the time? Because it's, you know, I thought actually I was right. After all this time, I've been proved right. And yet at the time, you know, there was no question of being asked to do another one. And I think looking back, the career would have been interesting to see what would have happened if I had been able to do another film like that, which was, you know, financially out of the question.
So in a way, you were ahead of your time, weren't you, with this particular film? Because it's very much of this moment to many people of my generation.
Yeah, I was kind of out of time. I mean, I knew when I was making it that I remember thinking there's a pivotal moment. I thought, do I have the Clash in the film? I thought, no, I don't. The Clash is going to date the film. Do I have Kraftwerk in the film? I thought, yes, I do, because Kraftwerk will not date the film. And I thought, I was very conscious, even though, I mean, it was my first film and I had no expectation of it actually having a life after an age of about 5 years. I nevertheless tried very hard when I was making it to give it a feeling of timelessness. Even if it seemed very kind of dated in certain ways, I wanted it in other ways to be a film that didn't date. And in an odd kind of way, that with time, that has proved one of the film's successes.
If you had to choose one film in the world that you had your favourite sound design on it, not your own, obviously, whose film would you choose?
It's a tricky question. I think one of the... I don't like his films, and I don't particularly like the whole film, but I think that the opening of the conversation where they're recording, where Hackman is recording that sort of two people walking in San Francisco, which is largely Walter Murch, it wasn't Coppola, I think is stunning. I think I could listen to that quite happily every day.
That was director Chris Petit talking to me, Max Hall, at this year's School of Sound. The Oscar-nominated sound designer of Fight Club, Being John Malkovich, and Seven, Ren Klai, spoke to me about being constrained in an age of technology where anything is possible.
Hi, my name is Ren Klai. I'm from San Francisco, and I create sound and musical textures for film and commercials.
Okay. Can you tell me why you've come to the School of Sound this year?
I was invited 2 years ago. I didn't want to come, actually, at first, because I was actually really intimidated about speaking in front of a bunch of people, and I had never spoken before in front of anyone, and so the thought of getting up there and having something pertinent to say that meant something to everyone was really daunting. But at the same time, I was always taught to do things that are dangerous or do things that you're afraid of, and that will push you a little bit creatively. And so I did it, and it really was a wonderful experience for me personally, in that it sort of rejuvenated within me what it is about music and what it is about sound that excited me in the first place from the very beginning. So it kind of stimulated me again, and it was fantastic. It was just a great experience for me to do. So coming back the second year, I was actually really looking forward to it.
Well, within your talk, one of the main features there was the fact that you were talking about how sound is sometimes overused, and this idea that we should get back to sort of, you know, minimizing what we do.
Well, the reason why I bring up Les Paul is that a lot of people don't realize that, aside from the fact that was and is a fantastic jazz musician, he was actually an incredible innovator and was really quite responsible for creating what we call sound on sound today, and multi-track recording technology, and helping advance the technology with Ampex Corporation in the United States to create the first multi-track tape recorders. But before he had gotten into tape, he was doing multi-track recordings to acetate, which is disc, LP, what we still know as an album. And what he would do was that he would record in his basement, or in his garage rather, to an acetate recording machine that he sort of fashioned himself. And he would play a background part, call it the drums or the bass line or the rhythm guitar, and then on a separate machine he would then replay the first recording, and as he was replaying that he would overdub live on top of it to a second acetate machine. And what's so remarkable about the example that you'll hear is that he had to do all of this in one take without a mistake, and if he made a mistake he had to start all over again. And it's phenomenal when you realize that what he's doing is recording to an actual piece of acetate all the way through. And what you'll hear is an incredible recording. This one's called How High the Moon, and it's just phenomenal. And it also features his wife, who's a singer named Mary Ford.
Somewhere there's music, I'll paint the tune. Somewhere there's heaven, how high in the moon. There is no moon above, and love is far away too. Till it comes true that you love me, it's I love you. Somewhere there's music, ponder how far. Somewhere there's heaven, it's where you are. In the darkest night would shine if you would come to me soon. You will still my heart, how high the moon.
Technology that enables us to do so much that perhaps the subtlety is lost. For instance, today we've heard about how they make sound on ER, and that's a completely sort of, it's like a pavlova, they're really overdoing.
Walter and I are about as on opposite ends of the spectrum as possible creatively, although you know we work in a very different environment. His world is television. It's the deadline is a known factor. You know it's going to have to air next Tuesday at 8 o'clock, and it has to get done, and it's a monumental job, and it's phenomenal what he and his crew are actually capable of putting together in such a short amount of time. I would never be able to do that under that sort of pressure. But my approach is, of late actually, has just been to, as best as possible, use some sort of forced constraint within my own work. In other words, to limit myself to, let's say I'm using a program like Pro Tools, for example. Nowadays, Pro Tools has so many tracks that you can record to. You know, it's limitless. It's 192 at, you know, 96 kilohertz and so on and so forth. And you can layer on top of this, on top of that, and never get rid of anything and never make a decision and never decide something that you are never going to change once you lay it onto tape, or rather onto disc now. So by creating a forced constraint, such as I'm only going to give myself 4 channels to do this, or I'm only going to give myself 8 channels to create this feeling, what's great about that is then it helps you and helps me focus on what it's about that it is that I'm doing in the first place. And if I can get an emotional response, even if it's not quite the right thing, but if I can find the moment, if I can discover when that sound moment should happen and when it shouldn't, when I should stay out of the way and be quiet, and where if it's a scene and there's dialogue, I need to help lift it somehow or create tension. What's great about forcing a constraint is that you can get more quickly towards the end of the scene, or rather work on the scene as a phrase rather than the first 3 seconds, and then the next day the next 3 seconds, and then by the end, you, if you were to work that way and work very densely, you might very well miss the essence of what it is that you're actually supposed to be contributing to the film.
Now, I'm also wondering which sound designers have influenced you in your own work, and if you could pick one movie, which film would you say this is the perfect example of the use of sound in film?
That's a tough question because there's so many good ones. I would have to say it would be THX 1138 for several reasons. One is that my godfather, Henry Jacobs, who was actually a pioneer in electronic sound and music, and was a radio producer during his heyday, he's actually featured in the film. And also that Walter Murch's work is obviously prevalent in the film. And that the approach that Walter and both George Lucas took when they created the soundtrack to this film was a really beautiful and wonderful process, in that it was just the two of them. George Lucas would come in the morning and edit in the house in Mill Valley, which is actually right around the corner from where I was growing up. And then Walter Murch would have the night shift, and he'd come in and cut sound and so forth. And then in the morning, apparently, as legend has it, they would meet over breakfast and discuss things and create. And so what I really like about the sound in that film is that it's creatively, there's a very direct correlation between the filmmaker and the sound artist working together without a whole army of people in between confusing matters. And so consequently, when you listen to the film, it's beautifully presented in its simplicity, in its use of sound or its use of silence. And it's just beautiful. And some of the sounds that Walter Murch created for it were so simple. There's a sound, for example, if you are familiar with the film, towards the end when Robert Duvall's character is speeding through a tunnel, and there are these police that are on motorbikes that are chasing him. I don't know if you're familiar with the scene, but if you're not, definitely try and look at the scene, because what he did was, apparently, again, as legend has it, grab some women who were working in the Zoetrope building in San Francisco and had them come into the bathroom and scream at the top of their lungs in the bathroom to the Nagra analog tape recorder that he had, and it overmodulated the tape recorder and created these horrific sounding resonant frequencies. And that, with its overmodulation, was the main sound of these motorbikes. And so it's a really creative use of sound, and yet it's so simple, and because of its simplicity it works so beautifully. And so I would say that film most likely, and if not that, then the second film they did, actually it would be American Graffiti.
Now, out of all the work that you've done so far in your career, though you're quite young really, what are you most proud of in terms of sound, and that you feel that you've achieved exactly what you wanted to achieve?
You know, it's really funny you asked me that question, because if you had asked me that question 2 weeks ago, I think I would have said Fight Club. But I just listened to that film the other day and I hated it for some reason. I don't know why. I think it's just because you know, it was a different time, you know, and it's interesting to, you know, listen back to your work after a few years, because if you don't listen to it, you tend to remember it perhaps not accurately to how it really is. And so I think as of this moment, I'm most proud of the film that I just completed, which is Mark Forster's film called Stay, which is yet to be released, as that's freshest in my mind and in my heart right now. So I would have to say it's the film Stay.
You actually mic'd up the bridge on, yes, San Francisco, which is an amazing feat to do. It made me think of plugins and how sound designers are somewhat perhaps marred by the plugins they use, because you may have a brilliant sound that you perhaps, for instance, the sounds of the Golden Gate Bridge, and but then put an effect on it that takes away the original sound that had so much more, you know, resonance. Mm-hmm. I just wondered what you thought about, you know, this overuse of plugins, that people have got the same sort of sounds again and again because they're using the same effects palette.
Well, that's a really good question, and I think it just comes down to experience and ultimately settling into your work with the proper perspective of what the goal is and what you're trying to achieve ultimately. I think that all of us, when we first start getting excited about sound, and now with the computer and plugins, as you mentioned, we get excited about, oh, wow, listen to that. Ooh, let me amplify that. And you get excited about it. And I think it's a natural process to go through, and you might overdo it. It's sort of like if you're cooking and you discover rosemary or herbs de Provence, and you put way too much in, and you overpower it, and you know your sauce is ruined. But after a while, you taste it and you go, I use too much herbs of Provence on this. You know, if I just tone it back a little bit, it'll be more delicious. And I think ultimately, if you keep working with your sound and you step away from it and get away from your work a little bit, which I think is actually a very important thing for all of us to do, take a break, you know, listen to some music, go outside, go see a film, come back and look at it fresh. And that first gut instinct that you have of your work, if you're really honest with yourself and really listen to it, you can hear perhaps that you're overusing that plugin or overusing something for the sake of having it.
Obviously, for some of the films that you've been involved with, that's come out of direct involvement with the directors. Mm. Do you find it quite hard to find sound work at this time in the States?
Well, it's always difficult because it's a very competitive field, and there are many people working in it, and so it's very competitive and it is very difficult. But, you know, I think the most important thing to remember is to just do the best work that you can do, and hopefully someone will appreciate it and want to use your work or collaborate with you because of your unique work. So I would very much encourage people to create and record their own sounds, and in so doing they become original. And because they're not using sounds, say, from a library and so on, then your work or the work that is created by this process is unique, and your sound will be unique in that way. And so I think that's a very important thing to remember.
That was sound designer Ren Kleiss talking to me at the School of Sound. I also took time to talk with composer Gabriel Yaid, who, having worked with Jean-Luc Godard, is most known for his collaborations with Anthony Mangelia, as well as writing the score of Betty Blue and The Talented Mr. Ripley. He discussed his approach to integrating music with image.
Well, my name is Gabriel Yaid. I'm a composer and happen to also compose for films and for ballet. And I've done many films in Europe until 1996, where I started with Anthony Minghella, a very beautiful and fruitful collaboration on English Patient, Mr. Ripley, and Cold Mountain. I have scored also other films like Message in a Bottle, City of Angels, Sylvia recently, and I'm preparing my new film, a new film by Anthony Minghella called Breaking and Entering.
And also Betty Blue.
And of course, yeah, Betty Blue. This was in the European part, where I did Betty Blue, The Lover. I've worked with Jean-Luc Godard, with many good directors like Costa Gavras and all that. This was my European period. And I'm really willing to go back to this work in Europe because it's much more eclectic and you don't feel yourself like pigeonholed in just one style of music. So I'm very lucky because the job I do is just the most wonderful job. It takes you to heaven, it takes you to hell, it takes you everywhere.
You also used to produce François Hardy.
Yeah, I produced François Hardy, Michel Jonas, Enrico Macias, Gilbert Bécaud, Charles Aznavour, many people. It was my job, you know, to pick the songs with Françoise, I would compose the songs as well. But to pick the right songs, to re-harmonize it and to orchestrate it and to be really producing. And this, I made it in a way just to learn music, because I was not meant to be an orchestrator. I'm born as a composer, and any composer should be also orchestrator, because you cannot divide this. If you are a composer, you have to orchestrate. So I have been like deprived of half of my ability, and found myself orchestrator. But destiny has been always so good to me that I had to go through the orchestration and producing song in order to have time to learn and to buy scores and to spend my money on that.
So at this time, did you work with Serge Gainsbourg ever?
I've worked with him for a song with Catherine Deneuve, but I was very friend with Jacques Dutronc and François Hardy, and I used to meet him very often in this place, and we had some discussion when he could have, because he loved drinking and partying. But he is a phenomenon in writing. He one of the most fantastic poet, I would say, in the 20th century.
Coming back to the School of Sound, is this the first time that you've ever been to this symposium?
Yes, that's the very first time, and I'm here thanks to Walter Murch, because Walter came very often here, and when Larry called him, Larry, who I've met like just 15 days ago, Walter recommended, I said it's a very important event, those people are fantastic, they love cinema, they love sound and all, you have to go and to do it if you are available. And I met Larry, and it was so nice, this meeting, that I said, of course I go. You know, I like to talk, not to do lecture, because I'm not so academic, but I like just to communicate the passion which really lives inside me. And of course, if I have in the audience composers or directors, I think it could be very useful for them to know that there are around people who love film and who love music and who are here also to, in a way, what I was saying, to elevate audiences and not just to provocate emotions and feeling and hit you in the stomach and the tummy. It's about touching you in the heart, in the deep soul.
Which particular soundtrack are you actually the most happy with?
I think it is The Talented Mr. Ripley. Though in this soundtrack there is jazz, there is classic music, and there is, I think, 8 tracks from me. I like also The English Patient, but Mr. Ripley has so much eclecticism in a way. You hear a piece of jazz by Miles Davis, then you hear Matt Damon singing My Funny Valentine, and then you have a Vivaldi piece and the score, and all this is melt in a beautiful way. And also because I think that the production of this soundtrack is really good. The sound is really interesting. I have recorded this in Abbey Road with John Richards, who is a fantastic engineer. He lives in America, but very often he comes to London to work with me.
And tell me about using Abbey Road. Obviously, many people, many musicians dream of ever going there. Is it your ideal space?
Yeah, the space is an ideal space. The studio is a fantastic studio. It has a great acoustic. But on top of that, the most important is the people who are there. The engineer, the assistants, the people who run the place. They are my friend. It's like my family. And you know, my office, Studio Abbey Road is 3 Abbey Road. My office is 5 Abbey Road. So I'm renting a flat to Abbey Road Studios, and I'm really their neighbor and I'm a member of this family. There is a magical sound, a magical feeling for a composer. It's like if I was without proportion, of course, Haydn in the Esterhazy court, or Bach in the Weimar court, and I feel surrounded by music, by competition, by musicians coming in and out, project, film project. So it's very inspiring, and it puts me in a fantastic atmosphere in order to be creative.
I'm very jealous.
Yeah, I know. Everybody's jealous.
So thinking about what I found interesting again today was to hear one of your early pieces of music. Well, your first film, you were asked to make a score for Jean-Luc Godard, and it's interesting to hear that you had not heard of him at the time.
Well, I'm still unaware of many directors, because again, it's not that I have any contempt for film. I love films, and I have seen many, many films in my life, and I have some culture in this. But I'm not a fan of images, because in a way, I live so much inside, and music comes from above and inside. And I feel that anything which is inside, or even nature landscape, is so inspiring to me, much more than images. Images are the last... the last event, the last incarnation of a project. It's like all these things which have been in the fog, like the script, location and all that, become real on images. And what talks to me is not reality, is my feeling of what could be the reality.
Certainly. And what I found of interest was also that your early music, you said you were using Moog synthesizers.
Yeah. Listen, I was always interested by all these new keyboards and devices. It was brand new in 79. So I worked with a Moog ARP, the small mini Moog. I worked with a Prophet one. I worked with a Polymoog and a sequencer. And I've always been fond of these instruments because it could also trigger a new inspiration in your work. So, and I remember also being the first person to work on Fairlight. Fairlight became a very trendy sampler later. But the very first Fairlight, I started it in 1981, and they so much loved my use of the Fairlight at the company Fairlight that they have used my tape as a demo to sell the Fairlight. So what I want to say is an orchestra, we know it's made with string section, woodwind section, horns, brass, percussion, and harp. But then if you make your orchestra bigger and adding instruments, not in order to replace those instruments, but just to, in a way, to enhance the spectrum of an orchestra, then it becomes very interesting.
And another thing that you talked about at the School of Sound, which I found of interest, was the fact that you had made a film in the past called Moon in the Gutter,
yeah,
which you used the sounds of carpenter's tools.
Yes, in 83, so it was a long time ago. And this engineer, Pierre Gamet, who is really a very nice person, very intelligent and a great artist, at the end of the day, instead of having his day off, his night off, he would go on the set or whatever in the nature and record what he called son seul, it means sounds alone. And so he gave me all these carpenters, birds, many different things. And I decided to exploit it, to write for these instruments. So I put it in the Fairlight. And instead of writing, let's say, an ostinato for strings orchestra, I wrote it for carpenter's tools. And actually, in The Moon in the Gutter, I have two pieces. One called La Folie Ouvrière. It means the worker craziness, madness. Another one called La Folie des Docks, the Docks madness. And it's exactly the same music. One is performed by a string orchestra, and the other one is performed by samples of wood, of carpenters and worker on a naval, how do you call this, construction.
And is this available, this soundtrack?
Of course. I'm releasing now, I decided to release all my first music, film scores. So I have merged with a company called Cinefonia on internet, and I've already released two soundtracks. The first one encompasses Sauf qui peut la vie of Godard and Melville, because, you know, in a CD you cannot put only one LP. At the time it was LP. So the first is this. The second CD already released on the market and on internet is Camille Claudel, probably one of my most beautiful score and writing, I would say. Now is coming another CD called The Orientals, which all the music which have been influenced by my remembrance of my childhood and which has a oriental flavor. And the fourth CD about to be released end of April is The Moon in the Gutter, with many bonuses I'm adding. And it's still, I must say, usually I don't listen to my music because it's done, it's done, it's over. I have to move forward. But I've listened to La Moon in the Gutter, La Lune dans le Caniveau, and I find it really very interesting still today.
So if you had to think about your own personal favourite soundtrack for a film, not a film that you've been involved in, do you have a favourite sound composer or a favourite film, really, that you think this is where sound is used the best?
Well, I would say a very old film by Disney called Fantasia. But it's a little nasty to say this because Fantasia is only Stravinsky, Tchaikovsky, Paul Dukas and classic composer. But I found this is the most beautiful marriage between music and animation. This is one. Apart from that, I have a great respect and admiration for one composer, unfortunately only one. And this guy is Bernard Herrmann, who did all the Hitchcock films, major of Hitchcock films, because he has brought into film music kind of spirit, of ethic, something that nobody probably has brought before and after. And he's like my brother. I feel like he's my brother. He is a classic composer who has given to film the right music, which you could play without the film or in the film. In both cases, it helps an audience, and in the other one, it really elevates you. He was a very demanding composer, and you can just, if you listen to any of Psycho or Vertigo or Marnie, you hear that. I mean, it's real fantastic music, creation, imagination in sounds. His lineup are amazing. His lineup would be 8 trombones, 8 flute in G, 4 percussion. It's not always the regular, you know, the plain full orchestra. But he, this guy, I can feel, although I haven't met him, that he was somebody who was exploring all the time, searching. He wouldn't just sit on his habits and repeat it over and over through the films.
And do you find, because of you've become known now for some certain kinds of films, like The English Patient, yeah, that you feel that you're being asked to repeat and this gets quite, you know, dull for you?
Yeah. You know, when I got this Oscar in 1997, I have been immediately contracted for 2 films which were like kind of English Patient. And it happened to me that I had to accept it because I was still starting. And slowly I decided to stop that. It's just about you, whether you want only to make money and to become famous, or you just don't want the music to leave you one day. Because music is a spirit. And if you don't really do your duty towards her, which is a duty is searching all the time and writing all the time, then one day she could abandon you and quit you and leave you. So I'd rather not take projects because they don't help me to improve my skills, and also because you are a kind of victim of trendiness, of a trend, and I don't want to go through that. I don't want. So I decided sometimes not to make money and to just, you know, be loyal to music. But you know, Morricone is involved with Sergio Leone very early in the process. Sergio Leone has shot many what we call Western spaghetti. He shot it having headphones on his cans on in his ears, and having the demo from Morricone. Nino Rota and Fellini had this partnership as well. So, but how to establish it as almost as a rule? Every time you are hired, you should have more than 3 months.
Yeah, it does seem to me a very short time. But like you said, it could, if you spend too many months, you could get fed up of the film too. Out of Boredom, that was where you said one of your best pieces was made. Doing Mr. Ripley, you had got fed up with the piece and tried something new.
Yeah, I was fed up because all the music I've written for Mr. Ripley was too slow to me. And you know, like a breathing, you don't breathe all the time the same way. You just want to have fun, let's say. So I decided to have fun. And what I do usually when I have a theme, I explore it in all the ways possible, whether it's useful for the film or not, but it's useful for me. It's useful in the compositional process.
Thank you.
That was the composer Gabriel Yared in conversation with me, Max Hall, at the School of Sound. As the School of Sound is an international event, I caught up with Academy Award-nominated sound designer Tom Fleischman, who's worked with Martin Scorsese, Jonathan Demme and Spike Lee. We discussed his distinctive approach on films such as Goodfellas, Silence of the Lambs and The Aviator.
My name's Tom Fleischman, and I'm a re-recording mixer. What you would call here in the UK is a dubbing mixer. I work on feature films, motion pictures, a little bit of television, but mostly feature films. The responsibility of a re-recording mixer, a dubbing mixer, is to record the final soundtrack that winds up printed on the film that gets played in the theater when the film's released. And that involves blending and balancing all of the sound elements, dialogue, music, and sound effects that go into making the soundtrack.
Though you're based in New York, you've worked with Scorsese and many other well-known directors. Does that mean you're working with a big production team?
Yes, usually. I mean, there's a number of directors that live in New York. Marty Scorsese, Jonathan Demme, Spike Lee, Mike Nichols, Woody Allen, among others. And there's a few re-recording mixers that are able to make a living working on their films. The team that we work with, it begins with the picture department, the picture editor, and his or her assistants. Then when the film is cut, it's handed off to a team of sound editors who prepare the tracks for the mix. And what they do is they take the editor's track, which consists of the production dialogue track, and they record ADR. And they take those production tracks and those ADR tracks and prepare the dialogue portion of the soundtrack for the mix. There's another sort of subcategory there of sound effects editors who prepare all the sound effects for the mix. And that means selecting the sound effects. They sit in a spotting session with the director, and they go through the film, deciding, you know, what kind of sounds he wants to hear in any given scene, take copious notes, and go out and collect those sounds and synchronize them to the picture, and prepare the tracks for the mix. And then the third element would be the music elements, and usually that consists of a score that's recorded or written by a composer and then recorded in a studio. And a music editor will then take those tracks and again synchronize them to the picture. So what is brought to me when the mix begins is a set of dialogue tracks that includes dialogue and ADR and group ADR, which is groups of people for party scenes, incidental walla hubbub type of, you know, stuff that happens out in the street, or, you know, any kind of crowd stuff like that. They get actors into the studio and record those tracks. And that comprises the dialogue. And I've got to integrate the ADR, which is the dialogue that's principal characters, which is recorded after the film has been shot in a studio to picture, where they try and synchronize their voice to what they're watching on the screen. And the ADR editor will fine-tune the synchronization of those tracks. The principal dialogue tracks, which are recorded when the film is shot, and these group ADR tracks, those all have to be blended together and made to sound natural. With the sound effects, those are really comprised of three categories, which is ambiences or atmospheres, just general background tracks, hard sound effects, things like doors and cars and airplanes and explosions and gunshots, and Foley. Foley are sound effects, incidental sounds like footsteps, movement, skin sounds, people, you know, rubbing their hands together or slapping or clapping or anything like that, which you wouldn't find in a sound effects library necessarily, that you wouldn't be able to go out into the world and record. They have to be done in a studio, and generally they're done to picture, just the way ADR is. Someone just stands and watches the picture and walks on a variety of surfaces for footsteps and synchronizes the sound effects that way. So those are basically the elements that come to the mix. And then I've got to take all those elements and play them in sync with the picture, balance them out, and record them on a final track. And that's how the process works.
So we're talking about thousands of sounds here for each picture you're using, because obviously instead of using the actual natural sounds that are recorded while the film is being shot, you're recreating those sounds. That seems to me an odd thing about Hollywood movies, this sort of hyper-real use of, say, even the sounds of someone's hands rustling, for that noise to be added in to a picture.
That's true. The track that's recorded when the film is shot, which is we generally refer to as the production track, forms the basis of the track. I mean, that's really the backbone of the whole thing, the foundation. But the recordist on the set is really only concerned with capturing the dialogue. And he's not really concerned with things like footsteps and movement and rustle of clothing. So very often those things are missing. And you might not really miss them necessarily, but when you do add them, it really brings to life, you know, in some sense it's hyper-natural, but in another sense it can become very natural and it can really bring the visual image to life. So it's very helpful to have that stuff.
Now, what I wondered was, is it not possible for someone to be on set recording just those sounds, the ambient sounds in the room, rather than actually recreating them from a sound bank?
It's possible, and they do that, but it's really not enough. And generally, it's hard to do because they don't have the time between each setup of the camera. They don't really have the time. There isn't a quiet enough place to go to get it. There's always something going on. There's generators, there's trucks, there's people milling around. So although you can get certain specific things, if they're using, for example, a specific car in the production, the sound recordist will try and get some sound from that specific car because it might be difficult to find that car after the production closes down. But generally, you know, those kind of things, they call them wild track, is very useful to the sound editors, but it's usually not enough. They've always got to augment it and sweeten it with stuff from a library. Or if it's not from a library, they go out and record. For example, on The Aviator, we went to the desert out in California and hired a bunch of airplanes and pilots and went flying and recorded these airplanes. And those were the tracks that are used in the film. Because they couldn't, there were no airplanes on the production. All of the airplanes in The Aviator are CGI. It's all computer generated. So they didn't really have those things. And those sounds didn't exist on the production. They couldn't get them. So Eugene Garrity, the sound designer, found someone who knew some pilots and found these old airplanes. And we went and recorded these vintage airplanes. And that's what made the sound work. That's why those scenes work the way they do.
Now, thinking about your work as a editor, because really you're mixing together the sounds in the final stages, what kind of programs are you using? Should I assume that you're using Pro Tools?
We do use Pro Tools. Generally, we're not recording to Pro Tools, but most of the elements that are brought to the mix are brought on Pro Tools. All of the dialogue, certainly all the sound effects, and most of the time the music. I could say exclusively nowadays, in the last 3 or 4 years, it's always almost exclusively on Pro Tools being brought to the mix. One of the problems that we've had with Pro Tools is that it would be wonderful if we could just keep everything in the Pro Tools and just manipulate and process the sound within the Pro Tools so that it never leaves the Pro Tools, and that we could just take the elements that, you know, are in the Pro Tools session and manipulate them into a final track. But the problem is that there's so many elements and they're coming from so many different departments that usually I wind up on a big feature with 4 or 5 Pro Tools sessions running into the console to provide all those elements. So we can't really record it on the same Pro Tools that it's coming from. And Pro Tools hasn't developed a way to interface their machine with the console that I'm using so that we could record to a Pro Tools. So at this time, we're still trying to work that out. We're still looking for some kind of a device that we can use as a recorder. As of now, we're recording on a Kai, which is a sort of antiquated digital recorder. It's an 8-track digital recorder, and we record 3 or 4 of them for our masters. But we're hoping that within the next year or so, Pro Tools will come up with a system that will allow us to use our console to control the record functions of the Pro Tools so that we'll be able to record right into a Pro Tools as well.
So how many tracks are we talking about, really, on the average film? Say, for instance, The Aviator, how many tracks?
Hundreds. I mean, literally hundreds of tracks. The bulk of that, of course, would be sound effects. The dialogue tracks could be split up into, usually the dialogue comes in on a 24-track Pro Tools. And then you would have another Pro Tools session that would have the ADR, and another Pro Tools session that would have the group ADR. So you might have a total of 48 or 60 tracks of dialogue elements. Music generally would come in on 24 tracks. And those are split up into 5.1 outputs. A 5.1 output would be a left, center, right for the screen speakers, a left and right surround, and a subwoofer channel. Makes up five channels plus the subwoofer, which counts as 0.1 of a channel. So the sound effects would come in, say, two or three of those split out with different elements so that we have some control in the mix on balancing them. And then a number of just left, center, rights, and a number of mono elements as well that we would then place in the scene where it's appropriate.
You're mixing this all down into 5.1 stereo. What machine do you finally put everything into?
We're putting it into a Akai DD8, a number of them. When we do our masters, what we're mastering on is separate stems. We call them stems. One for dialogue, one for music, and one for sound effects. And actually, in the last few years, I've been recording two sound effects stems just to keep the Foley separate from the hard effects so that I can, it's complicated to explain, so that I have separation on the Foley separate from the backgrounds and the hard effects, because one of the other things that is my responsibility is to prepare an international version where we remove all the English dialogue and just have the music and sound effects, which is then given to the other territories and they put in their own languages, they dub their own languages. So we've got to be able to prepare that. And it's very useful to have separate control over the Foley to be able to fill in stuff that when you remove the production track, you lose anything that's on it. And if there's footsteps or incidental effects that are on that production track, those have to be replaced with Foley. What we do is the stem masters are made in the mix. That's the actual master that we're making. We then take those three separate 5.1 stems or four separate 5.1 stems and combine them into a print master, which is a single 5.1 master. And that is the master that is used to make the optical track that gets printed on the film and also is used to make whatever DVD track or any other type of release format.
Yesterday you illustrated one of the great films that you worked on, which was Goodfellas, Martin Scorsese. And in fact, you chose to illustrate it with one of what I would say was my favourite scene in the film, which was the part where it's sort of the 1970s and Henry Hill is about to be busted by, is it the FBI?
Yeah.
Now, that is a very, very long sequence of events that are brought together with music, and it's all about the music. I know that you mix this all together, which is obviously a grand feat. It was interesting to hear that there was, for instance, a bit of the music from the film Performance. I don't know if you're familiar with that film. And then again, the Stones later in that scene. Did you have any say whatsoever on choosing any of the music in the shots?
No, I don't generally have any say on what's chosen to go into the film. In the case of Marty Scorsese, he chooses all that stuff himself. That's part of what he does. And he does it very well. I do have ideas. I do make suggestions. And I can't really think of a situation where I came up with an idea that was actually used. But yeah, who knows? It's not over yet.
Is that quite frustrating? I have to say, as a DJ myself, I'd be so frustrated if I couldn't, you know, have more of a say in the actual choice of selection of music, especially when they're not using, say, a soundtrack score. They're using collages of music.
I don't really feel that way, no. I don't see that as part of my job. If I wanted to do that sort of thing, I'd be a director.
Other sound designers have said at the conference that sometimes they have certain ways of getting their way by saying, for instance, a tune is too expensive to use, or they may actually turn up the the level of that sound, so it sticks out, because they want to sort of influence slightly how the sound design sounds, because they know best through practice. Do you find that you ever have to resort to those sort of techniques?
Certainly. Yes, I do. That's a well-known technique. If you don't like an ADR line, you want to use a production line, play it really, really loud so it sticks out, and the director eventually will say, get rid of that. You know, let's go back to the production. On the other hand, there's often situations where a director will ask me to do something. And this happens a lot, and I hate to admit it on the radio in front of everyone, but it does happen. Director will say, you know, can you play that a little bit lower, that music a little bit lower? I may not agree with it. So I'll run through it just to listen to it and see what I think, you know, I should do, sort of as a rehearsal, as an experiment, without ever changing it, just listening to it to see what's there, see what direction I want to go in. And before I get a chance to do anything, he'll say, oh, that's so much better. And I haven't done anything. And I'll say, oh, well, good. Okay. I'm glad you liked it. And leave it the way it was. And there it was as it was originally. And he thinks that he's changed it. And I know that he hasn't, but I'm not going to let on. So.
See, that's the real interesting stories behind how these films are made. Because obviously your ears can become numb from hearing the same piece. You can lose the subtleties. And that maybe that happens quite a lot. How do you keep your ears fresh?
I have to take breaks, and nowadays with digital, and there are no breaks. In the old days when we were working analog, if a track needed to be fixed, if something needed to be cut out, if there was a pop or a footstep over a word, or they wanted to, you know, remove something for the track or reposition something, they would have to take it down, put it on the bench, and we'd have a 15 or 20 minute break while that happened. That doesn't exist anymore. I mean, right now, all of the workstations are there on the stage, and it takes 10 seconds to do that kind of thing. You want to move a line three or four frames, and you can do it in 10 seconds. So I don't get the types of breaks that I used to get. And it's very important for me, first of all, just for my health, my hearing health, that I don't bombard my ears constantly for hours at a time, because it can be damaging. So I have to sort of force myself to stop every half an hour, and just say, look, we need 10 minutes. Let me go outside, clear my head. And that's what I do. I'll go out and walk around the block, or just, you know, go to a quiet place for a few minutes and then come back in and keep going.
Now, I'd also like to ask you which film that you've worked on that you're most happy with the sound.
Oh, there's quite a few, really. Goodfellas is one. I'm very proud of that work. I think it's some of my best. There's a Jonathan Demme film, which is not a very good movie, but I think it sounds terrific, called The Truth About Charlie, and nobody really saw it. It was a remake of Charade with Mark Wahlberg, and unfortunately it's not a good film, but I think that the track is spectacular. I'm very happy with The Manchurian Candidate. I did a film with a photographer, a documentary. He's actually started out as a fashion photographer named Bruce Weber, and he started making movies. He made a movie called The Chop Suey Club, which I think is just a masterpiece. If anyone ever gets a chance to see it, it's absolutely brilliant, and I'm very happy with the way that came out as well.
Yeah. Also, what are your thoughts about the School of Sound? What have you enjoyed yourself whilst being here?
I like doing this kind of thing. It's different for me. You know, normally I'm stuck in a dark room with no windows for hours and hours and weeks at a time. So it's nice to be able to get out and come to London and meet new people. And I like working with students. I always like it when people, you know, professors bring students to the studio to see what a mix is like, talking to them. And I very much enjoyed hearing some of the other presentations. You know, I like the radio thing that David Osman and Judith Walcott did very much. I like Tom Holman's presentation about 5.1. Ren Kleiss was very interesting. Walter Newman was very interesting. So I've enjoyed not only the other speakers, but I've also enjoyed meeting the delegates and the students that are here trying to get some information from me.
That was the sound designer Tom Fleischman in conversation with me, Max Hall, at the School of Sound. If you'd like more information about this annual event, have a look at www.schoolofsound.co.uk. I'd like to thank the organisers of the School of Sound, Diane Friedman and Larry Sider,
for their help with this program. This is Mags Hall signing off. Take a look at my website, www.youarehere.co.uk, or email me, Mags, M-A-G-Z, at resonancefm.com. If you enjoyed this program, why not tune in to my weekly live session program, You Are Here, which is heard on Resonance on Monday nights at 8:30 till 10:00.